The Guardian.
And as the 20th century reaches the halfway point, the scientists' dream of unifying the basic concepts of the universe continues to occupy the genius of Professor Albert Einstein.
One of the greatest scientific thinkers of the 20th century was undoubtedly Albert Einstein. Known primarily for his groundbreaking theories of relativity, he's often called a genius. But even geniuses can get things wrong. Throughout his early career, Einstein was convinced that the universe didn't extend any further than the edge of our galaxy, the Milky Way. He believed our universe to be static and disagreed with those who suggested it was expanding. But thanks to observations by the astronomer Edwin Hubble, he was eventually convinced otherwise. Since then, with each new technological advance, astronomers have been able to look further into space, proving just how vast the expanding cosmos is.
So whenever we look out into space, we actually look back in time because light takes time to reach us. And so, yeah, the stars are pretty far away and light takes years to reach us from there. But the thing I was looking at with WMAP, and I still look at, is actually almost 14 billion years ago.
The scale of our universe is incredible. Trying to get our heads around the expanse of planets, stars, black holes, and other weird cosmic objects spanning billions of light years into the distance, it's dizzying to think about. So we rely on scientists to try and quantify what's out there and explain it.
So I wanted to be able to share both what we know and also the process of knowing it, because I think not everyone has a sense of how we actually do science and the process of coming up with some of our discoveries. And I thought that was exciting to share, as well as the kind of current state of what we know about, you know, this magnificent universe.
This week, we welcome astrophysicist Joe Dunkley onto the podcast to talk us through the history of our universe, as well as some of the remarkable and sometimes overlooked contributions of pioneering female astronomers. I'm Hannah Devlin. This is Science Weekly.
I'm Joe Dunkley, Professor of Physics and Astrophysics at Princeton University.
So you're now a professor at Princeton and you spend your time studying the origins and evolution of the universe. But I wanted to ask, what sparked your interest in these big questions in the first place? Was it something that you got into at university, or was it something, you know, that you used to wonder about as a kid?
I think it took till university to understand that there were these questions that were so interesting. I think the first real taste of it I had was at university when I studied physics. We had a course in special relativity where for the first time I realised that our concepts of time and space were, we could be confounded by them. What we thought was true was not always true. Found that fascinating.
Joe went on to study theoretical physics and received a PhD in astrophysics from the University of Oxford. After finishing her studies, she joined a group of scientists at Princeton University who were working with NASA's Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, or WMAP for short.
And this was a NASA satellite that was out a million miles from Earth, looking into deep space, looking as far as you can look out into space and back in time.
You said looking back in time. How far back in time were you looking with this probe?
Pretty far. So whenever we look out into space, we actually look back in time because light takes time to reach us. And so, yeah, the stars are pretty far away and light takes years to reach us from there. But the thing I was looking at with WMAP, and I still look at, is actually almost 14 billion years ago. So the light has been travelling to us for almost the entire age of the universe, and it just reaches us today.
Being able to look deep into space like this, and therefore back in time, allows scientists like Joe to look at what the universe looked like shortly after its formation, the so-called Big Bang.
It's unrecognisable compared to how it was today. So we're talking about a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang itself. And the universe back then was actually pretty boring. It was pretty featureless. What we see now around us, we see this sort of magnificent cosmic structures of galaxies filled with stars and with planets going around them and, you know, the complexity of us within that. But if we step back to the very early times, the thing that I look at, then actually the universe was kind of this almost featureless sea of particles, mostly hydrogen, a bit of helium gas. We think perhaps some extra particles that we haven't identified yet, we call them dark matter. But so none of the things that we now see around us were there back then.
So were there stars there? And if there weren't stars, I mean, it's not like looking into the night sky and actually seeing something. What are you seeing when you look back into time?
There was actually just this very diffuse light that was created in the very earliest seconds of the universe's life, really at the Big Bang itself. You know, we call it primordial light. It's ancient light that was made really during the Big Bang. Unless it hits something, it just keeps traveling. And so this light, which kind of was set off from every point in space and has been traveling outwards, some of it is just reaching us today, now. But we can't see it with our eyes. Its wavelength, it's the kind of light that it is it has longer wavelength than our eyes can see. It's microwave light. It's the same kind of light that you might have in your microwave oven. If we put a telescope into the sky, one that can pick up this wavelength of light, then we see it. It's this kind of faint glow all around us.
This primordial light makes up what is known as the cosmic microwave background, which was first detected back in 1964. But it wasn't until the launch of the Cosmic Background Explorer, better known as COBE, in 1989, that scientists were able to measure the features of this light.
When we look at this light, we measure kind of how hot and cold it is. What that's telling us is actually it's giving us a sense of like how dense the universe was in different places back then. Like if you have a big lumpy region or a space that's got less stuff in it, it'll show up as different temperatures. So COBE got to see them, but WMAP got to see them in much sharper precision and with better sensitivity. So it had, you know, a larger mirror to capture the light and more sensitive detectors that could see it. And so we got to measure these features in great detail. It gave us this model that remarkably can kind of account for the whole 14 billion years history of the universe in broad brush terms.
After working on WMAP, Jo went back to Oxford, where she worked as part of a team studying data collected not by a satellite, but by a telescope.
We can't always send satellites into space, even though that's the best observing place for getting outside Earth's atmosphere. If we want to build a bigger telescope, then that usually has to be here on Earth. And so we needed a telescope with a 6-meter mirror, and you can't easily launch that onto a satellite. So we put it in the best place on Earth for looking at the skies in this wavelength, which is in the Atacama Desert in Chile. It's one of the highest locations for a telescope in the world. It's at 5,000 meters elevation in this very high and dry desert.
But it's still quite an inhospitable environment, that working up in a high altitude desert. What did you and what do your colleagues who spend long periods there find it like being kind of in this astronomy bunker in the middle of a desert?
Well, you have to acclimatise. So you stay down in the nearby town at around 2,500 metres elevation, and then you drive about 45 minutes straight up the mountain to 5,000 metres elevation. And the air is very thin. It's difficult to breathe properly. It's difficult to think properly. You do have to acclimatise. And of course, you take oxygen up for when you need it. And, you know, if people are working on difficult technical problems, they'll often use oxygen tanks to keep them going. But, you know, it is very basic. And our offices, you know, up there on the mountain are in a shipping container. And so it's not glamorous, but it's a beautiful place.
You'd imagine that might be a major issue, not being able to think that well when you're trying to solve, you know, questions around, you know, the origins of the universe.
Well, you aren't necessarily trying to solve those questions while you're up there. The things you're trying to do up there and make your telescope work, which you definitely need brain power for, and that's where you would use oxygen when you need it.
Part of Jo's work with the Atacama Telescope in Chile is looking at neutrinos, which are tiny subatomic particles, and specifically looking at the different types of neutrinos.
So there are three that we've discovered in lab experiments here on Earth. And we're trying to test whether we also see just three types when we look out into the universe. because there may be, for example, an extra type that don't behave in quite the same way and that kind of evade measurements in lab experiments here on Earth. Or there may be extra particles that behave a bit like neutrinos that also could be, you know, traveling through us now and that we haven't even identified yet, that could have been produced in the very early universe. And so we're looking to see, not only if we can see like whether there were just three kinds of neutrinos out in the bigger universe, or whether there could be even brand new particles that we haven't discovered before. With the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, we were able to say that it looks pretty consistent with three, but there could be room for an extra one.
Leaving telescopes and neutrinos behind, Joe's latest project has been writing a book, Our Universe, An Astronomer's Guide.
I've always loved talking about my science with the public. I mean, for a start, I enjoy it, but I also think it's part of our job as scientists to share the things we've learnt with the public. I mean, the public fund us, and we're doing things that involve answering big questions that, you know, humans have been asking for millennia. So if we learn exciting things, I think we should share them. So I wanted to be able to share both what we know and also the process of knowing it, because I think not everyone has a sense of how we actually do science and the process of coming up with some of our discoveries. And I thought that was exciting to share, as well as the kind of current state of what we know about, you know, this magnificent universe.
In the book, Joe writes about how technological advances have opened up new windows on the nature of our universe and its history.
There's been one, I think, very exciting recent advance, which is that astronomy is until very recently been only about looking at light. So whether that be visible light or other kinds of light, still, you just got to look with light. And now this new window is opened, and it's called gravitational wave astronomy, where there's this remarkable thing that if incredibly dense things are moving through space, like a black hole or a really dense star, there are these neutron stars that are densest of all stars. If they move quickly through space, if they're spiraling around each other or colliding together, they actually deform space-time itself and send out kind of ripples in space-time. And we can actually feel these ripples coming through the Earth, and with kind of special detectors that kind of sense them rather than look for them. We've now seen colliding black holes in space with this wonderful LIGO experiment.
So when we look back, that, you know, there were times when we couldn't see out beyond our own solar system or beyond the Milky Way. We thought that was the edge of the universe. Do you think in 50 years' time we'll look back at now and think, oh, we were living in, we had such a small kind of dark view of the universe, and now we can see, you know, all this extra stuff with gravitational waves? Do you think that that's what it will feel like when we, you know, look back 50 years to the present day?
I kind of hope so. The place where I could see that happening is partly we'll see more with gravitational waves. And then the other thing is we might have figured out how to look at this really big part of our universe that we haven't been able to look at yet, which is the stuff that we call dark matter. So we've worked out rather precisely that there seems to be about five times as much stuff out there that is invisible. And it might be just a new kind of particle. We're not quite sure yet. But if we can figure out a way of actually sort of seeing it, seeing signals from it, then that would be remarkable. There is a limit, though, on how much more we can see of our universe, because just like physically, we're limited to only looking out to places where light has had time to reach us from. So there is a finite horizon to our visible universe. That is the distance light can have travelled since the Big Bang. It's, you know, the distance light can travel in 14 billion years. So if we're going to uncover all sorts of new and unexpected things, they do have to be within the space that we already have access to.
So far, we've mentioned both Einstein and Hubble in the episode, well-known names in science, who both happen to be men. But after the break, we look at some of the exceptional women who have helped shape our understanding of the universe and why their stories have sometimes been overlooked.
Being able to be told and to see that, you know, scientists come in in all flavours, and that if you're a woman that you can be a successful scientist, I think that's really important. So I think we could be doing more seeing more in schools to show visible women scientists, because there are many of us, and I think people need to see that we exist.
We'll be right back.
Today in Focus is a new Guardian podcast that brings you closer to our journalism by getting behind the news every weekday. You'll join me, Anushka Astana, talking to people at the centre of the big stories impacting our world. We'll use personal perspectives and expert analysis to put you at the heart of what matters. Listen to Today in Focus and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen.
Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Hannah Devlin. Before the break, we heard from the astrophysicist Jo Dunkley about her career piecing together what our universe looked like in its infancy 14 billion years ago. While researching her new book, Our Universe, An Astronomer's Guide, Jo came across the stories of several women who've shaped our understanding of the cosmos.
I think that many of them were working at a time when they weren't perceived to be the leaders of the field. Many of them were actually working as assistants in rather menial jobs as astronomers. This was about 100 years ago, and even in the last, half a century ago. And so I think that they weren't in sufficient positions of power, many of them, to be seen as the leaders of the time. I think there's also probably a culture of deciding who the leaders are and then writing about them, and then they persist. And so their recognition is coming, but late.
One of the women you mentioned, or I should say girl because of her age, is Venetia Burney. Could you tell me about her contribution? That's an interesting story.
Yeah, Venetia Burney. So she's the girl who named Pluto, now dropped from our our solar system as a real planet, but still there as a dwarf planet. She actually suggested the name Pluto through her grandfather, who was a librarian at Oxford. Yeah, and so it actually turns out that she's the only girl or woman who's ever actually named a planet, even if it's now a dwarf planet.
Another example who has been recognised in the past few decades is Vera Rubin, who made a huge contribution in terms of discovering dark matter.
So she found out back in the 1970s, or she showed convincingly, that there was all this invisible matter in the universe. And she did it by looking at measuring how fast entire galaxies spin around. To look at how fast a galaxy spins around, you have to be able to look at it in quite great detail. And these are galaxies far beyond our own. So you need a telescope with excellent resolution. So she actually applied in the 1960s to use the best telescope available at the time for this, which was at the Palomar Observatory in California. But until then, there were quite strict rules, no women allowed. But Rubin persisted nonetheless, and actually was the first woman to be able to use it. There's a story that she, cut out a paper skirt and pasted it on the image of the man's figure on the bathroom door and said, look, now there's a women's bathroom. So anyway, she used this great telescope with her colleague Kent Ford, and they measured quite carefully how fast galaxies are spinning around. They actually use this, the Doppler effect, which is that as things are moving towards or away from you, the wavelength shrinks as it comes towards you and stretches as it goes away from you. They managed to measure very carefully how fast these galaxies were spinning. And the surprise was that the galaxies were spinning much too fast, and particularly the stars out at the edges of the galaxies, they were really going much too fast. And the explanation for this was that there was actually a much bigger amount of mass in the galaxy than you could see from the stars. And so, Rubin put forward the idea that actually there's a halo or sphere of invisible matter surrounding each of these galaxies.
It was heralded by many as an incredible achievement, and one that left many questioning, as with Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell, why the Nobel Prize Committee didn't think so too. Currently, there is a push by many in science to overturn biases and ensure that today's women take their rightful place on the timeline of important discoveries in astronomy. But, of course, there is still more that can be done.
I think that a big place where I'd like to see more change is making sure that the smart young women in schools are really encouraged to pursue science and physics through to university. I think so much of it is cultural perception of thinking, what kind of person should be a scientist, and being able to be told and to see that, you know, scientists come in all flavors, and that if you're a woman, that you can be a successful scientist. I think that's really important. So I think we could be doing more, seeing more in schools to show visible women scientists, because there are many of us, and I think people need to see that we exist.
In your research, Jo, you're often grappling with really complicated questions and sort of the nitty-gritty of these calculations about the universe. Do you ever have to just take a break and just acknowledge how incredibly vast and how incredibly complicated our universe is and these things that you're working on?
Well, it's funny. I think in my day-to-day research, not so much, because I'm quite stuck into the details of, you know, a particular, analysing particular data from a particular telescope, and I'm following a path within that.
So I guess that must be one of the nice things about writing a book, is reminds you that you're basically, you know, figuring out some of the biggest questions out there, and, you know, how incredibly cool your work is.
No, that's nice. It's nice to be able to take that step back. I think we get to do that as well when we kind of have to propose new projects, and we have to explain to, you know, funders, why is this important? Why do we care, and why should the public care? And that is an important part of our jobs, because we have to be convinced. I mean, the first job is to convince ourselves that it's interesting, and then why in the bigger picture of things, why is this an important question to ask?
Do you take your kids to look at the telescopes or look through telescopes ever?
I haven't so much yet. So my daughters are 1 and 5. I also have 2 stepdaughters who are teenagers. The fun thing I have done with them is that my telescope in Chile, we take regular shifts doing observations remotely. And so from my laptop in my living room, I get to control a 6-meter telescope in Chile by the press of a button. And so sometimes I would get my daughter to check whether the button was looking green, which means everything's fine, or, you know, if the button goes red, has something gone wrong?
And so have your daughter's got to swivel around the Atacama telescope, or whichever telescope it is?
Well, my daughter has helped me press go, yes, with my supervision. But it's an automated schedule, so the telescope knows what it's supposed to be doing.
That's brilliant. That's it for this week. If you want to get in touch with us, you can. Just email scienceweekly@theguardian.com or tweet @guardianaudio. And a link to Jo's book, Our Universe, An Astronomer's Guide, can be found on our website, theguardian.com/podcasts. This episode of Science Weekly was produced by Danielle Stevens. I'm Hannah Devlin. Until next time, goodbye.
Hi, Danielle Stevens here, producer of this week's episode of The Guardian Science Weekly. Before we sign off, I'd like to tell you about Guardian Jobs, which sponsored this week's episode. Guardian Jobs can help you find your good company. It promotes a world of work where potential flourishes by connecting people with rewarding careers at like-minded organizations, where values make the difference. Whether you're looking for a new job or you're a recruiter looking for the perfect addition to your team, you can trust Guardian Jobs to help you find your perfect match. So find your good company at gu.com/goodcompany.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.